This is Audible.
A long time ago, beyond a galaxy far, far away, Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Thrawn Ascendancy, Chaos Rising, by Timothy Zahn. Read for you by Mark Thompson. For thousands of years, it has been an island of calm within the chaos. It is a center of power, a model of stability, and a beacon of integrity. The 9 ruling families guard it from within. The expansionary defense fleet guards it from without. Its neighbors are left in peace. Its enemies are left in ruin. It is light and culture and glory. It is the Chiss Ascendancy. Prologue. The attack on the Chiss Ascendancy homeworld of Chela was sudden, unexpected, and despite its limited scope, impressively efficient. The 3 large warships came out of hyperspace on widely spaced vectors, driving inward toward the planet with spectrum lasers blazing at full power toward the defense platforms and the orbiting Chiss Defense Force warships. The platforms and ships, caught by surprise, nevertheless took less than a minute to begin returning fire. By then, the attackers had altered their directions, angling in toward the cluster of lights spread across the icy planetary surface that marked the capital city of Chaplock. Their lasers continued to fire, and as they came within range, they added salvos of missiles to their attack. But ultimately, it was all for nothing. The defense platforms easily picked off the incoming missiles, while the warships targeted the attacking ships themselves, blasting them into rubble, making sure that any fragments entering the atmosphere were too small to survive the journey. Within 15 minutes of the attack force's arrival, it was over. The threat had ended, Supreme General Bakif thought grimly, as he strode down the central corridor toward the cupola, where the syndics and the other aristocra were assembling after making their way back from the shelters. Now came the real sound and fury. And there would be plenty of both. As the supreme ruling body of the Ascendancy, the Syndicure liked to project an image of thoughtfulness, nobility, and unflappable dignity. Most of the time, aside from the inevitable political wrangling, that was close enough to the truth. But not today. The Syndicure had been in full session, and the speakers had had their own private meeting scheduled for later in the afternoon, which meant nearly all of the Ascendancy's top-level aristocra had been in the offices, corridors, and meeting rooms when the alarm sounded. The shelters beneath the cupola were reasonably roomy and marginally comfortable, but it had been decades since the last direct attack on Chela, and Bakif doubted any of the current government officials had ever been down there. 2 hours of forced idleness while the defense force waited to see if there would be a follow-up attack hadn't gone over well with them. And Bakif had no illusions that the coming storm would be thoughtful, noble, or unflappable. He was right.
"What I want to know,"
the speaker for the Ufsva family spoke up after Bakif had finished his report,
"is who the aliens are who dared think they could get away with an attack against us. A name, General. We want a name."
"I'm afraid I can't give you one, Speaker," Bakif said.
"Why not?" the speaker demanded. "You have debris, don't you? You have data records and bodies and weapons profiles. Surely a name can be gleaned from all that."
"The Ascendancy has been attacked,"
The speaker for the Myth family cut in gravely, as if the others might somehow have missed that fact.
We need to know who to punish for such arrogance.
Yes,
the Usfa said, throwing a brief glare down the table. Bakif suppressed a sigh. In times gone by, major threats to the Ascendancy had usually drawn the ruling families into a unity that superseded the usual political maneuvering. He'd held a small hope that today's attack might spark such a response. Clearly, that wasn't going to happen. In the case of the Usfa and Myth, in particular, those families were in the midst of a particularly tangled campaign, with a newly opened mining field on Thiartera as the prize. And the Usfa was clearly annoyed at having had some of his spotlight stolen by his family's current chief rival.
More than that,
he added, his glare daring the Myth to interrupt again.
We need assurance that the Defense Force has the resources to defend the Chiss against further action by these unidentified enemies.
The Questis data link reader lying on the table in front of Bakif lit up as a fresh report came in. He picked it up, propping it at an angle on his left palm while he slid his finger along the edge to scroll the screen.
The Sindicure need not be concerned about their safety, he said. I've just received word that 4 additional warships from the expansionary fleet have been rushed in from Naporar and are moving to support the Defense Force ships already in place.
He winced to himself. Young men and women, ready to give their lives to protect their homeworld. Noble and honorable, and a sacrifice, if it was ever required, that he and everyone else currently in the cupola knew would be a complete and utter waste. Fortunately, it didn't look like any such sacrifice would be needed today.
And if they attack other worlds within the Ascendancy?
The Usfa pressed.
Other ships have already been sent to bolster the patrol forces of the neighboring systems in case they're the targets of subsequent attacks, Bakif said. Has anyone else reported attacks or enemy sightings?
The speaker for the Klar asked.
Not as yet, Speaker, Bakif told him. As far as we can tell, this was an isolated incident.
The speaker for the Abik family gave a theatrical little snort.
I seriously doubt that, General, she said. No one sends warships against the Ascendancy on a lark and then goes home. Someone out there is plotting against us. That someone needs to be found and taught a serious lesson.
It went on that way for another hour, with each of the 9 ruling families, and many of the great families who had aspirations of joining that elite group, making sure to get their outrage and determination on record. It was, for the most part, a waste of Bakif's time. Fortunately, extensive experience in the military had taught him how to listen to politicians with half his mind, while focusing the other half on more urgent matters. The speakers and syndics wanted to know who had attacked the Ascendancy. They were looking in the wrong direction. The more interesting question was not who, but why. Because the Abik had been right. No one attacked Chila for the fun of it. That went double for an attack that cost 3 major warships without providing any obvious gain. Either the attacker had misjudged badly, or else he'd achieved a more subtle goal. What could such a goal look like? The majority of the Sindicure clearly assumed that the attack had been a prelude to a more sustained campaign, and once they finished their posturing, they would undoubtedly start urging the Defense Force to pull its ships inward for the protection of the major systems. More than that, they would probably insist the expansionary defense fleet likewise withdraw from the borders to augment them. Was that the goal? To keep the Chiss looking inward and not outward? In which case, bowing to the Sindicure's demand for security would play directly into the enemy's plans. On the other hand, if the Syndics were right about this being the start of a full-fledged campaign, leaving the expansionary fleet out in the chaos would be an equally fatal move. Either way, if they guessed wrong, it would be too late to correct the error by the time they knew the truth. But as Bakif weighed the possibilities, it occurred to him that there was one other possibility. Perhaps the attack wasn't meant to draw the Ascendancy's attention from something that was about to happen, but to distract it from something that had already happened. And that possibility, at least, he could look into right now. Surreptitiously, he keyed a search order into his Questus. Midway through the cupola session, as he continued to make his soothing noises to the Aristocra, he had the answer. Maybe. One of Bakif's aides was waiting when the general finally made it back to his office.
Were you able to locate him?
Bakif asked.
Yes, sir, the aide said. He's on Naparar, undergoing his final round of physical therapy for the injuries sustained during the Vagari pirate operations.
Bakif scowled. Operations that, while successful in a military sense, had been a complete disaster on the political front. Months later, many of the Aristocra were still brooding over that whole mess.
When will he be free?
Whenever you wish, sir, the aide said. He said he would be at your disposal whenever you wanted him.
Good,
Bakif said, checking the time. Half an hour to bring the Whirlwind to flight status, 4 hours to get the Naparar, another half hour to get a shuttle down to the Chiss Expansionary Fleet Med Center.
Inform him that I want him ready in 5 hours.
Yes, sir.
The aide hesitated.
Do you want the order logged, or does this qualify as a private trip?
Log it,
Bakif said. The Aristocra might be unhappy when they found out about this. The Sindicure might even assemble a tribunal somewhere down the line to waste more of his time with useless questions. But Bakif was going to do things strictly by the book.
Order from Supreme General Bakif,
he continued, hearing his voice drop into the tone he always used for formal orders and reports.
Preparing transport for myself and Senior Captain Mithron Yorodo. Destination, Dioya. Purpose, investigation of a derelict ship found 2 days ago in the outer system.
Yes, sir,
the aide said briskly. His voice was studiously neutral, giving away nothing of his own personal feelings on the matter. Not all those who thought poorly of Captain Thrawn, after all, were members of the Aristocra. At the moment, Bakif didn't care about any of them. He'd found the first half of the why. Now there was only one person he trusted to come up with the other half.
Memories 1.
Of all the duties foisted on mid-ranking family members, Aristocra Mithurfianico thought sourly as he strode down the senior school hallway. Recruitment was one of the worst. It was boring, involved way too much travel, and more often than not was a waste of time. Here on Rentor, physically close to Chila, yet paradoxically in the backwater of the Chiss Ascendancy, he had no doubt what the outcome of the trip would be. Still, when a general, even a newly minted one, said he had a promising recruit, it was incumbent on the family to at least check it out. General Bakif was waiting in the assembly overlook balcony when the Aristocra arrived. The expression on the general's face was one of controlled eagerness. The face itself was far too young to be attached to a field grade officer, but then that was what family connections were for. Bakif's eyes lit up as he spotted his visitor.
Aristocra Mithurfianico?
He asked.
I am he, General Bakif.
I am he. And with that formality over, they could move on to the far less awkward use of titles and corps names.
So, where is this student you thought was worth my flying halfway across the planet for?
Thurfinn asked.
Down there,
Bakif said, pointing at the lines of students reciting the morning vows.
Third row back on the right.
So he was a line leader. Impressive, but only mildly so.
Name? Kivu Ranuru.
Kivu? Not a family Thurfinn was familiar with.
And?
He prompted as he pulled out his questus and keyed in the family name.
And his grades, aptitude, and logic matrix are off the boards,
Bakif said.
Makes him a prime candidate for the Teharim Academy on Naporar.
Thurfinn said, peering at the record. Kivu was about as obscure a family as the Chiss Ascendancy had ever spawned. No wonder he'd never heard of them.
And you contacted us, why? Because the myth still have two appointment slots left for this year,
Bakif said.
If you don't bring Voran in, he won't have another chance until next year.
Would that be such a catastrophe?
Bakif's face hardened.
Yes, I believe it would, he said, offering his own questus. Here's his school record.
Thurfinn pursed his lips as he scrolled down the screen. He'd seen better, but not very often.
I don't see any indication that his family has prepped him for military service.
No, they haven't, Bakif confirmed. It's a smaller family without the resources or access the myth have for such things.
If they thought he was so exceptional, they should have found or made the resources,
Thurfinn said tartly.
So you think the myth should step to the front and just welcome him with no questions asked?
Ask all the questions you like, Bakif said. I've arranged for him to be pulled out of first class for an interview.
Thurfinn smiled tightly.
Are the Aristocra that predictable?
The Aristocra, no.
Bakif matched Thurfinn's smile.
But their rivalries are.
I imagine so,
Thurfinn conceded, lowering his eyes again to Voron's records. If the boy lived up to even half of his potential, he would be a worthy addition to the Myth family. Once, thousands of years ago, families had been just that. Groups of people bound by blood and marriage, and closed to everyone else. But the inherent limitations of such a system had led to decline and stratification, and some of the patriarchs had begun experimenting with methods for absorbing outsiders that didn't involve marriage. The result had been the current system, where likely prospects could be brought in as merit adoptives, with those who proved themselves especially worthy rising to trial-born and possibly even ranking distant. Voran certainly fit the criteria for becoming a merit adoptive. More important, if the myth took him, the Arisi wouldn't be able to snatch him up. One of the many family rivalries Bakif was no doubt thinking of when he spoke of predictability. But even that was beside the point. The Sindicure had finally agreed to the Defense Force's long-standing pleas to expand its capabilities and mandate, and the newly formed Expansionary Defense Fleet was the result. Its mission was to watch over Chiss interests in parts of the Chaos extending beyond the Ascendancy's borders, to learn who was out there and assess their level of threat. And for once, the Aristocra had actually been generous with their military funding. The Expansionary Fleet's new ships, bases, and support facilities were already under construction, and they were going to need all the competent officers and warriors they could get. This Voran looked like someone who would fit into such a role. A man who might make a name there, both for himself and for his family.
Fine, he said. Let's go talk to him. See how he stands up to a proper interrogation.
I trust the compound isn't too far away,
Vuron said, as Thurfian's car flew swiftly across the Rentor landscape.
I'm already missing all of today's classes. My instructors would be displeased if I missed tomorrow's as well.
You'll be all right,
Thurfian said, hearing the strained patience in his voice. Did the boy really not understand the depth of the honor that had been bestowed upon him? Apparently not. Attending his classes was important. Adoption into one of the 9 ruling families wasn't. Rentor wasn't exactly a political and cultural hub, and Thurfian knew he had to make allowances for a certain degree of ignorance. Even so, such a lack of awareness set Vuron apart from even the unsophisticated commoners around him. Still, if Bakif's assessment was correct, the boy would be heading for a military career. Politics weren't nearly so important there. If Vuron was rematched to the myth, which was hardly yet guaranteed. Thurfian had sent in his own report, but there was still an interview to be conducted by the counselors who oversaw myth interests on Rentor, followed possibly by a short meeting with the local Patriel herself, if the counselors were suitably impressed. Once all that was over, the results would be forwarded to the homestead on Chila for final review, and only then would Vuron learn whether or not he'd been selected to be a myth merit adoptive. The whole process typically took 2 to 3 months. Thurfian had seen it take as many as 6. His Questus signaled. Pulling it from his pocket, he keyed it. It was a script message. A very brief script message. Vuron accepted as merit adoptive. Thurfian stared. Accepted? Impossible. The interviews, the Patriel evaluation, the homestead review. But there it was, staring him in the face. The process had been short-circuited by someone, and none of the usual procedures were going to matter. In fact, none of them were now even necessary. Presumably, the Patriel had received the same message, and the only thing that would happen when they reached the compound would be the brief ceremony detaching Vuron from the Kivu family and rematching him to the myth.
Is there trouble?
Vuron asked.
No, nothing,
Thurfian said, putting the Questus back into his pocket. So on the strength of Thurfian's own interrogation, plus perhaps the boy's school records and evaluations, he was accepted? That made no sense. Impressive though the boy might be, there still had to be more to it. Clearly, someone high up in the family had been keeping watch on Thurfian's mission today. That same someone had apparently also been following Vuron's life, and had already decided that taking him was in the myth's best interests. So if the decision had already been made, why had Thurfian been sent to do an interview in the first place? Surely his recommendation didn't hold that much weight with the homestead. Of course it didn't. Thurfian had been sent here to help cover the fact that Vuron had already been selected for rematching. Pure politics. Because with the 9 families, it was always about politics. He frowned, his thoughts belatedly catching up with him. He hadn't reacted in any way when he received the message. He'd been an aristocrat and political creature long enough to know how to keep emotions like surprise out of his face and voice. Yet, somehow Vuron had recognized that the message had been disturbing enough to inquire about it. He eyed the boy again. That kind of observational skill wasn't common. Maybe there was more than he'd realized. Some spark that would someday bring honor and glory to himself and his family. Apparently someone at the homestead thought so too, and that someone had determined that the family on the receiving end of that glory would be the Myth. There was still the question of whether or not the boy would be sent to the Tehreem Academy, but with Vuron's unidentified benefactor pulling the strings, Thurfinn expected that would also be a foregone conclusion. He scowled at the landscape racing past beneath them. He didn't like being manipulated. He very much didn't like proper and time-honored procedures being thrown out the window on someone's whim. But he was an aristocrat of the Myth, and it wasn't his job to approve or disapprove of his family's decisions. His job was merely to do the tasks he was given. Perhaps someday that would change.
No, no trouble, he said. I just received word that you've been accepted.
Vuron turned widened eyes on him.
Already?
Yes,
Thurfinn confirmed, secretly enjoying the other's confusion. So he could be surprised. And at least he knew enough politics to recognize the unusual nature of the situation.
We'll presumably go through the ceremony when we reach the compound.
As a merit adoptive, I assume.
So the kid also knew something about the ruling families.
That's where everyone starts,
Thurfinn told him.
If and when you go through the trials, you'll move up to Trialborn.
And then, ranking distance,
Vuron said thoughtfully. Thurfinn huffed out a silent breath. That, at least, would never happen. Not to someone from such an insignificant family.
Perhaps. For now, just start getting used to the name Myth Ronduru.
Yes,
the boy murmured. Thurfinn studied him out of the corner of his eye. The boy might bring glory to the Myth, the way Bakif thought. He might just as easily bring shame and regret. That was how the universe operated. But either way, it was done. Vuron was no more. In his place now stood Thrawn. Chapter 1. There were times, Bakif thought distantly, when it was good for a man to stare out of the relative stability of the Chiss Ascendancy into the chaos. It was a chance to appreciate all the Ascendancy was and all that it meant. Order and steadfastness, security and power, light and culture and glory. It was an island of calm amid the twisted hyperspace lanes and the ever-changing pathways that slowed travel and stunted trade for all those who lived out there. The chaos hadn't always been that way, or so the legends went. Once, at the dawn of space travel, it had been no more difficult to move between any of the stars than it was now to travel in the Ascendancy. But then, millennia ago, a series of chained supernova explosions throughout the region had sent huge masses tumbling at high speeds between the stars, some of them demolishing asteroids or whole worlds, others sparking more supernovas with their near-light-speed impacts. The movement of all those masses, coupled with regions of heavy electromagnetic flux, resulted in the constantly changing hyperlanes that made any voyage longer than a couple of star systems difficult and dangerous. But that instability was a two-bladed knife. The limitations that stifled travel and thus helped protect the Chiss from invasion also slowed recon and intelligence gathering. There were dangers out there in the darkness. Hidden worlds and tyrants who sought conquest and destruction. One of those tyrants had apparently now set his sights on the Ascendancy.
Are you certain this is the way?
He asked the young woman at the helm of their shuttle.
Yes, General, I am, she said. A flicker of controlled pain crossed her face.
I was part of the team that found it.
Bakif nodded.
Of course.
There was another short silence, another moment of gazing out at the distant stars.
There,
the woman said suddenly.
10 degrees to starboard.
I see it, Bakif said. Take us alongside.
Yes, sir.
Their ship moved forward, steadily closing the distance. Bakif gazed out the viewport, his stomach tight. It was one thing to see hollows and recordings of a destroyed refugee ship. It was something else entirely to look personally upon the stark reality of slaughter. Beside him, Senior Captain Thrawn stirred.
This wasn't pirates, he said.
Your reasoning?
Bakif asked.
The damage pattern is designed to destroy, not immobilize.
Perhaps the majority of the destruction was inflicted after they plundered it.
Unlikely, Thrawn said. The angle of the majority of the shots indicates an attack from the rear.
Bakif nodded. That was the same analysis and logic he'd followed, and it had taken him to the same conclusion. That logic plus one more crucial, terrible fact.
Let's get the obvious question out of the way,
he said.
Is this ship at all related to the ones that attacked Chila 2 days ago?
No,
Thrawn said promptly.
I can see no artistic or architectural connection between them at all.
Bakif nodded again. That, too, had been his conclusion.
So it's possible the two incidents are unrelated.
If so, it would be an interesting coincidence, Thrawn said. I consider it more likely that the attack on Chila was a diversion, to draw our attention inward and away from this event.
Indeed, Bakif agreed. And given the cost of the diversion, it further suggests someone really doesn't want us taking a good look at this ship.
Indeed, Thrawn said thoughtfully. I wonder why they left the wreckage, instead of destroying it completely.
I can tell you that, sir,
the pilot put in.
I was on the patrol ship that spotted the attack. We were too far away to intervene or to get any real sensor data. But the attacker apparently spotted our approach and decided not to risk a confrontation. By the time we arrived and began our investigation, it had escaped back into hyperspace.
So we already knew about the attack, Bakif added. The diversion was then presumably an attempt to push it out of our attention.
At least until more time had passed, Thrawn said. How much time, sir, do you estimate?
Bakif shook his head.
Impossible to say for certain, but given the Sindicure's outrage at the Chila attack, I'm guessing they'll keep up the pressure on the fleet to find the culprits for at least the next 3 or 4 months. Assuming, of course, that we don't identify them before then.
We won't, Thrawn said. From the recordings I saw of the attack, the ships looked old, even marginally obsolete. Whoever their master was, he chose ships that'll most likely bear little resemblance to what he's using now.
Bakif smiled grimly.
But then, a little resemblance may be all we need.
Perhaps.
Thrawn gestured toward the wrecked ship.
I assume we'll be going aboard?
Bakif looked at the pilot. Her cheeks were tight, the skin around her eyes pinched. She'd been aboard once, and clearly had no desire to go back.
Yes,
he said.
Just the two of us. The shuttle crew will stay here on watch.
Understood, Thrawn said. With your permission, I'll prepare the boarding suits.
Go ahead,
Bakif said.
I'll join you in a moment.
He waited until Thrawn had left.
I presume you left everything as you found it?
He asked the pilot.
Yes, sir,
she said.
But...
But?
Barkeef prompted.
I don't understand why you wanted it left intact instead of bringing it in for a more thorough investigation,
she said.
I can't see how anything in there will do you any good.
You may be surprised, Barkeef said. We may both be.
He looked toward the hatch where Thrawn had gone.
In fact, I'm counting on it.
Barkeef had seen the hollows the patrol had sent to the Syndicure on Chela and the Expansionary Defense Fleet headquarters on Naporar. Like the ship itself, the reality was far worse. Wrecked consoles, fried data storage banks and modules, destroyed sensor clusters and analysis pods, and bodies. Lots of bodies. Or rather, the remains of bodies.
This wasn't a freighter.
Thrawn's voice came softly through Bakif's helmet speaker.
It was a refugee ship.
Barkeef nodded silently. Adults, mid-agers, children. The whole range of life experience had been represented. All of them slaughtered with the same brutal efficiency.
What did the fleet's analysis give us?
Thrawn asked.
Precious little,
Barkeef admitted.
As you already noted, the ship's design isn't one we've seen before. The victim's nucleic code isn't in our data listings. The size of the ship suggests it didn't travel overly far, but there are a lot of planetary systems and small nation clusters in the chaos that we've never visited. And their physical characteristics.
Thrawn waved a hand.
Not easy to read,
Barkeef said grimly, shivering in spite of himself. Explosive rounds had left very little for even the best reconstruction team to work with.
I was hoping there might be something you could glean from what they left behind. There are a few things,
Thrawn said.
The basic ship design has certain characteristics that likely translate to other aspects of their culture. Their clothing, too, is distinctive. In what way?
Barkeef asked.
Material, design, patterning, all that and more,
Thrawn said.
There's a certain air about such things, an overall feeling that forms in my mind. Nothing you can codify for us.
Thrawn turned to him, and through his faceplate, Barkeef saw the other's wry smile.
Really, General?
He said.
If I could write all this down, I certainly would. I know,
Barkeef said.
It would be a lot easier for all of us if you could. Agreed,
Thrawn said.
But rest assured, I'll be able to recognize these beings when I see them again. I presume your plan is to search for the ship's point of origin.
Under normal circumstances, I would definitely do so,
Barkeef said.
But with the Syndicure in its current state of uproar and outrage, it might be difficult to detach a task force from Ascendancy Defense. I'm prepared to go alone if necessary.
Barkeef nodded. He'd expected Thrawn to volunteer, of course. If there was one thing the man enjoyed, it was chasing down enigmas and working through puzzles. Add in his unique ability to see connections others couldn't, and the fact that a large percentage of the Aristocra would be happy to have him out of their sight for a while, and he was the perfect person for the job. Unfortunately, it wasn't that easy.
I'll need something reasonably well-equipped for a mission of this sort,
Thrawn continued, looking around at the wreckage.
This Ringhawk would do quite well.
I thought that would be next,
Barkeef said sourly.
You do know it was taken away from you for a reason, right?
Of course,
Thrawn said.
Supreme Admiral Geforsk and the Council was displeased by my actions against the Vagari pirates. But surely that anger has dissipated by now. Perhaps,
Bakif said evasively.
However, well, let's just say that your reputation among the other council members continues to be tenuous.
Certainly the Defense Hierarchy Council's annoyance at Thrawn's actions had been the official reason for him being removed as the Springhawk's commander. Not just his unauthorized action against the pirates, but also the subsequent death of Syndic Mithrasophis and the loss of valuable alien technology. But behind the scenes, there'd been other factors in play. Thrawn's successful campaign, whether the Aristocra approved of it or not, had elevated the Springhawk's name and prestige, and the Ufsa family had decided they wanted the ship to be commanded by one of their own. A quiet petition to the council, probably an even quieter exchange of favors or future owings, and Thrawn was out. All strictly against protocol, of course. The Aristocra weren't supposed to have any influence over military assignments, but that didn't mean it never happened. The point was that, as usual, Thrawn had seen only the surface situation and completely missed the political subtleties. Still, this might be a good opportunity to remind the Ascendancy's civilian leaders that the Council, not the Syndicure, was in charge of the military. The Syndics had taken away the Springhawk. It was time for the Council to take it back.
Let me see what I can do,
he said.
The Springhawk's scheduled to join Admiral Aralani's punitive attack on the Potatis in a few days. But we should be able to get you back in command after that. Do you really think the Potatis are responsible for the Chima attack? I don't know,
Bakif admitted.
Nor does most of the Council. But one of the Syndics trotted out that theory, and the rest are warming to it. Regardless, the Potatis have been poking at the edge of the Ascendancy again. So a quick punitive slap was in order anyway. I suppose that's reasonable,
Thrawn said.
Instead of waiting until after the operation, though, I'd like to join the ship before the attack. Not necessarily as a commander, but to observe and evaluate the officers and warriors. That might be possible,
Bakif said.
On the other hand, why not as commander? I'll run it past Aralani and see if she approves. I'm sure she will,
Thrawn said.
I assume I'll also be assigned a Skywalker for my investigation. Most likely,
Bakif said. The Skywalker Corps was stretched thin these days, but without knowing how far Thrawn's investigation would take him, it would be inefficient to make him travel at the much slower jump-by-jump speed.
I'll see who's available when we get back to Naperar. Thank you.
Thrawn gestured aft.
I presume the attackers here left little to find in the engine compartment or the supply rooms. Little to nothing,
Bakif said grimly.
Mostly just a few more exploded bodies. Regardless, I'd like to see those areas. Of course,
Bakif said.
This way.
For a long moment, Mid-Captain Ufsa Makro gazed at the fresh orders on the Questis his first officer had handed him. No, not his officer. Senior Commander Plilkaril Morph was now Senior Commander Mithron Yerodo's officer. And no longer first, but second. Simakro himself had become Thrawn's first officer. He looked up from the Questis at the man standing stiffly in front of him. Carol was seething, though he probably thought he was hiding it.
You have a question, Senior Commander?
Simakro asked mildly. Carol's eyebrows twitched just a bit. Apparently, he'd expected the Springhawk's captain to be as angry at the unexpected orders as he was.
Not so much a question, sir, as a comment, he said, his voice tight.
Let me guess,
Simacro said, lifting the Questus slightly.
You're outraged that my ship's been taken away from me and given to Senior Captain Thrawn. You're wondering if we should lodge our complaints individually or jointly, and if jointly, which of our families should be contacted first. You think we should also protest to Admiral Ar-Alani, Supreme Admiral Jafosk, and the Defense Hierarchy Council, probably in that order, arguing that changing a ship's command structure on the eve of battle is both foolish and dangerous. And you absolutely think we should show our displeasure by obeying Thrawn's orders as unenthusiastically as possible. Does that about cover it?
Carol's mouth had started dropping open somewhere around Simacro's second sentence, and was now as far open as Simacro had ever seen it.
Yes, sir. It does, Carol managed.
Well then, Simacro said, handing him back the Questus. Since I've now said all of it, there's no reason for you to do so. Return to your duties and prepare for the change in command.
Carol's throat worked, but he gave a brief nod.
Yes, sir,
he said, and turned to go.
One more thing, Simacro called after him.
Sir?
Simacro let his eyes narrow. If I ever catch you disobeying an order, anyone's order, or obeying a legal order slowly or improperly, I'll personally have you brought up on charges. Clear?
Very clear, sir,
Carol said between stiff lips.
Good, Simacro said. Carry on.
He watched Carol's rigid back as the others strode down the corridor toward the Springhawks Bridge. Hopefully, Simacro had convinced the younger man to at least pretend enthusiasm for the ship's new commander, even if he didn't actually feel any. Which was a facade that Simacro himself had better make sure was nailed up in front of his own feelings.
Because he was furious. Furious, outraged, betrayed, all of it.
How dare the Council and Supreme Admiral Jafosk do this to him and the Springhawk? Supreme General Bakif's starry-eyed attitude toward everything Thrawn touched was well known. But surely Jafosk had more sense.
Still, the orders had been cut.
And protesting the way Carol wanted would do nothing except add fuel to an already simmering fire. So Simacro would do his job. And he would make sure the rest of the ship's officers and warriors did the same. And he would hope very hard that whatever political mess Thrawn made this time wouldn't blow up in all of their faces.
Memories 2.
The journey ended, and Alyostov brought herself out of third sight into the muted light of the Chiss Defense Force transport Tomra's bridge. She lifted her hands away from the navigational controls, a hollow feeling in both stomach and heart.
Senior Commander?
She asked tentatively, looking at the helm officer seated beside her.
We've arrived,
he confirmed.
Thank you. I'll take it from here.
Okay,
Alyostov murmured. Unstrapping, she stood up and walked across the quiet bridge to the hatch. She walked through the opening and continued down the empty corridor toward the captain's quarters, where she and her caregiver had been given space. The Tomra never went outside the Ascendancy, so it didn't have a proper Skywalker suite. Mayful, Alyostov's caregiver, had complained about that very loudly, which had made Junior Captain Vorlip mad right back at her. On Alyostov's other ships, her caregiver usually met her outside the bridge and walked her back to the Skywalker suite. But after Mayful's fight with Vorlip, she declared she wouldn't leave the room until they reached Naporar, and had told Alyostov she'd be walking back and forth alone. And as Alyestov walked the long corridor, her eyes blurred with tears. There was no reason to have a Skywalker on this trip. She knew that. The routes within the Ascendancy weren't like the ones out in the chaos. Here, the pathways were clear, and the pilots knew how to get where they were going. That was why the fleet had put Alyestov's test here. Trips like this were a safe way to see if a Skywalker could still do her job. The pilot hadn't said anything, neither had Junior Captain Vorlip, but Alyestov knew. She hadn't been able to keep the Tomra on the right path. The pilot had had to correct the course as they traveled. Her third sight was mostly gone. Her job was ended. The only life she'd ever known was over. A full year ahead of the usual schedule. Her life was over. At age 13.
Are you all right?
Alyestov stopped short, rubbing away the tears that had kept her from seeing the other person's approach. A young man in a black uniform stood facing her a few steps away. There weren't any insignia pins on his collar, which marked him as a cadet, and his shoulder patch had a sunrise on it. That was one of the 9 families she knew, but she couldn't remember which one.
I'm fine, she said.
One of her other caregivers had told her once that she should never complain about how she was feeling.
Who are you?
Cadet Mithron Nuru, he said, journeying to the Tarahim Academy.
Who are you? Alyestov,
she winced, remembering too late that her identity was supposed to be kept a secret from everyone except the highest-ranking officers.
I'm the captain's daughter, she added,
repeating the lie she was always supposed to give if anyone outside the bridge crew asked. Thrawn's eyebrow rose just a bit, and Alyestov's sinking heart sank a little deeper. He didn't believe her. Not only was her life over, but she was probably in trouble now, too.
I mean... It's all right, Thrawn said. What's wrong, Alyestov? Can I help?
Alyestov sighed. She wasn't supposed to complain, but for once, she didn't really care what she was supposed to do.
I don't think so, she said. I'm just worried about... I don't know, about what I'm going to do.
I understand, Thrawn said.
Alyestov caught her breath. Had he figured out what she was? Her brief moment of uncaring rebellion vanished, leaving her once again fully aware that she was going to be in trouble.
You do?
She asked carefully.
Of course, Thrawn said. All of us feel uncertainty as we travel through life. I don't know specifically what concerns you, but I assure you that all the cadets aboard this ship are also facing changes in their futures. She felt a bit of relief, so he didn't know she was a Skywalker.
But you all know where you're going, she said. You're a cadet, and you're going to be in the Defense Force. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You're a ship captain's daughter, Thrawn said. That will surely open many opportunities. But just because I know I'm going to the Academy doesn't mean there aren't a great many unknowns. And uncertainty can be the most frightening of mental states.
And then, to Alyestov's surprise, Thrawn got down on one knee in front of her, putting his face a little lower than hers. Grown-ups almost never did that. Even most of Alyestov's other caregivers had usually stood straight up looking down at her.
But why all of us face a variety of paths, we all have the power to choose among them, he continued. You have that power as well. The power to choose which of those paths is the right one for you.
I don't know,
Alyestov said, feeling the tears start up again. What kind of choices did a 13-year-old failed Skywalker even have? no one had talked much to her about that.
But thank you for...
What's going on here?
The harsh voice of Junior Captain Vorlip came from behind her.
Who are you, and what are you doing here?
Cadet Mithron Nuru,
Thrawn said as he quickly stood up.
I was exploring the ship when I came upon your daughter. She seemed distressed, and I stopped to offer assistance.
You're not supposed to be in this corridor, Vorlip said sternly.
She walked past Aliestov and stopped in front of Thrawn.
Didn't you see the authorized personnel only signs?
I assumed they were intended to stop non-military personnel, Thrawn said. As a cadet, I thought I would be exempt.
Well, you aren't, Vorlip said. You're supposed to be back with the other cadets.
My apologies, Thrawn said. I merely wished to get the feel of the ship.
He bowed his head and started to turn away. Vorlip put out her arm to block his path.
What do you mean, the feel of the ship?
I wanted to study its rhythms, Thrawn said. The deck has subtle vibrations that reflect the ebb and flow of the thrusters. Our movement through hyperspace was punctuated by slight hesitations and swells. The airflow indicates small variations as we change direction. The compensators occasionally lag slightly behind course changes, with effects that are again transmitted through the deck.
Really?
Vorlip said. She didn't seem as angry now.
How many space flights have you had before this one?
None, Thrawn said. This is my first voyage away from my home.
Is it?
Vorlip stepped close to him.
Close your eyes. Keep them closed until I tell you otherwise.
Thrawn closed his eyes. Vorlip took him by the upper arms and, without warning, began spinning him around. Thrawn's arms flailed outward with surprise. His feet stumbled, trying to keep up with his body's movements. Vorlip kept him spinning and also slowly moved around with him. When she was a third of the way from where she'd started, she caught his upper arms and brought him to a stop.
Eyes still closed, she said, holding him steady. Which way is forward?
Thrawn was silent a moment. Then he raised a hand and pointed toward the Tomra's bow.
There, he said.
Vorlip kept holding him for a second. Then she let go and moved a step back.
You can open your eyes, she said. Return to your quarters. And don't ever pass that kind of sign until you're damn sure you're allowed.
Yes, Captain, Thrawn said.
He blinked a couple of times as he finished getting his balance. He nodded to Vorlip, nodded and smiled at Aliestov, then turned and left.
I'm sorry,
Aliestov said quietly.
It's all right, Vorlip said.
She was still looking at Thrawn.
Are you mad at him?
Aliestov asked.
He was only trying to help me.
I know.
Are you mad at me?
Vorlip turned and gave her a small smile.
No, of course not, she said. You've done nothing wrong.
But...
Aliestov stopped, feeling confused.
I'm not mad at anyone, Vorlip said.
It's just... It took me 15 voyages and 4 different ships before I developed that kind of awareness. This Mithron Nuru did it in one. Is that strange?
Very,
Vorlip assured her.
He seems nice,
Aliestov said. She paused, thinking about what he'd said about paths.
What happens to me when I leave here?
You'll be adopted, Vorlip said. Probably into one of the 9 ruling families. They like to have former Skywalkers.
Why?
It's a prestige thing, Vorlip said. I'm sure you realize that girls with your ability are very rare. It's an honor for one of you to be made a merit adoptive.
Elyastov felt her throat tighten.
Even when we're no use to anyone?
Don't say things like that, Vorlip said sternly. Every person is valuable. My point is that you'll be welcomed into whatever family adopts you. They'll take care of you, send you on to further education, and eventually find a career that you're best suited for.
Unless they throw me out.
I told you to stop talking like that, Vorlip said. They're not going to throw you out. Your prestige for the family, remember?
Yes,
Elyastov said. She didn't completely believe it, but there was no use talking any more about it now. But there was one more point.
Do I get to choose which family I want?
Vorlip frowned.
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know any of the details about how these things are done. Why? Are you looking at a specific family?
Yes,
Elyastov said.
The myth.
Really?
Vorlip glanced over her shoulder.
Like Cadet Thrawn?
Yes.
Vorlip huffed out a thoughtful breath.
As I say, I don't know how it works, but there's certainly no reason you can't ask. Actually, now that I think about it, a former Skywalker with your record should be able to ask for whatever you want.
And there it was. Vorlip had said it. Former Skywalker. Elyastov's navigational career was officially over. But strangely, it suddenly didn't seem to matter so much now.
That's what he said,
she told Vorlip.
He said I'd be able to choose my path.
Well, cadets say all sorts of things,
Vorlip said, dismissing both Thrawn and the conversation with a wave of her hand.
Come, I need you and your caregiver in my office. There are forms we need to fill out.
Mithron Nuru, he'd named himself, Elyastov reminded herself as she and the captain walked. Mithron Nuru. She would remember that. And when the time came, the Myth family would definitely be getting a request. Chapter 2. The personnel officer shook his head.
Request denied, he said briskly. Good day.
Mithaly Ostov blinked. Had she just heard him right?
What do you mean, denied?
She asked.
I have all the data work right here.
Yes, you do, he said. Unfortunately, it needed to be filed 4 days ago.
Thalias clenched her teeth. She'd had to fight the Myth family bureaucracy the whole way, tooth and tongue, to get them to agree to this. Now, too late, she understood why they'd suddenly backed off the fight and given in to her request.
I'm afraid I don't understand,
she said, forcing back her anger at the family. The man sitting in front of her was the key to getting her aboard the Springhawk, and she needed him on her side.
I'm a member of the Myth family. The Springhawk is being commanded by a member of the Myth family, and I was told the fleet offers the right of observation.
Yes, it does, the officer confirmed. But there are limits to that right.
He tapped his questus. Proper timing is one of them.
I understand that now, Thalias said. Unfortunately, the family didn't make that clear to me. Typical. Isn't there anything you can do?
I'm afraid not, he said, a little less truculently.
Putting the mess onto the Myth family instead of him had edged him at least a little closer to sympathy for her current situation.
There's processing time to consider, especially since the other senior officers' families have a right to challenge.
I see,
Thalias said.
Always comes down to the families, doesn't it?
It does seem to go that way a lot, the officer said,
his stiffness bending a little more.
Well, if I can't get aboard as an observer, is there any other way I can join the ship?
Thelius asked.
Some other job I could do? I'm proficient in computers, data analysis.
Sorry, he cut in, stopping her with an upraised hand. You're a civilian, and the Springhawk doesn't have any positions for civilians. He frowned suddenly. Unless... just a moment. He keyed his Questus, paused, keyed it again, scrolled slowly down the pages. Thelius tried to read along from her side of the desk, but the text was upside down, and he was using one of the scripts specifically designed to be hard to read that way. Here we go, he said, looking up again. Maybe. There's one job you might be able to take. The Springhawk's just been assigned a Skywalker, but a caregiver hasn't been appointed yet. You have any experience or qualifications in handling children?
Not really, Thelius said. But I was once a Skywalker myself. Does that count?
His eyes widened. You were a Skywalker? Really?
Really,
she assured him. Interesting, he muttered, his eyes shrinking back to normal, and maybe just a little in the other direction. 100 years ago, all caregivers were former Skywalkers. Or so I've heard.
Interesting, Thelius said. There was her opening.
If she wanted to go for it. It wasn't an easy or obvious answer. That part of her life was far behind her. More than that, it was filled with some memories she'd just as soon leave there. Of course, many of those unpleasant memories were wrapped around the women who'd been assigned to look after her aboard her ships. Some of them had been reasonable. Others hadn't understood her at all. She would be on the other side of the relationship this time, which should help a lot. Maybe. If she was being honest, she would have to admit that she probably hadn't been the easiest of caregiver assignments either. A lot of that time blurred together, but she distinctly remembered several long-term sulks and more than a few full-rage screaming fits. To take that job onto herself, to face a Skywalker with all that entailed, to try to make a little girl's life less stressful. She squared her shoulders. Visiting those dark parts of her past would be hard, but it might be her only chance to once again see Thrawn. It would certainly be her best chance for real observation of him.
All right, she said. Yes, I'll take it.
Whoa, the officer warned. It's not that easy. You'd still need... He broke off as the door behind her opened. Thelius turned to see a middle-aged man stride into the office. Pinned high on his yellow outer wrap robe was the sunrise crest of a Myth family syndic.
I see I'm not too late, he commented. Mithaliastov, I presume?
Yes,
Thelius said, frowning.
And you?
Syndic Mithurfianiko,
the man identified himself, his eyes shifting to the officer.
I understand the young lady is trying to secure a place aboard the Springhawk.
She is, Syndic, the officer said, his eyes narrowing a bit more. You'll excuse me, but this is a matter for the fleet, not the aristocrat.
Not if she's going aboard as a Myth family observer,
Thurfian countered. The officer shook his head.
Her data work isn't in order for that.
Someone in the family delayed the processing, Thelius added.
I see,
Thurfian said.
And there's nothing that can be done?
There's an opening for the Skywalker's caregiver, Thelius said. We were just starting to talk about that.
Perfect,
Thurfian said, brightening.
What still needs to be done to make that happen?
It's not that easy, the officer said,
Of course it is,
Thurfian said.
The position's open, and the Myth family still has the right of observation.
The approvals haven't been completed.
I'm completing them now,
Thurfian said. The officer shook his head.
With all due respect, Syndic.
With all due respect to you,
Thurfian interrupted. He drew himself up. And suddenly Thalias had a sense of the true power of the Syndicure wielded. It stretched far past their political authority, carrying the full weight of Chiss history.
The Ascendancy lies under threat of attack,
Thurfian said, his voice low and dark.
The Defense Force and Expansionary Fleet need to stand at full readiness. Every ship that requires a Skywalker needs to have one, and a Skywalker cannot go aboard without a caregiver. The Springhawk leaves Naperar in 4 hours for combat. We don't have time.
You
don't have time to dither around.
He took a deep breath, and it seemed to Thalias that his stance and manner softened a bit.
Now, you have here a caregiver who's ready, willing, and able to serve. You have a family's authorization to be aboard. Surely you can find a way to provide the Springhawk the resources it needs for the task that lies ahead.
For a moment, he and the officer remained silent, their eyes locked. The rivalry between the fleet and the Aristocra. But there were reason and urgency in Thurfian's argument, and the officer clearly knew it.
Very well, he said.
He lowered his eyes and worked his questus a moment. All right, he said, looking up at Thalias.
Your orders, instructions, and authorizations are on your questus. Read them and be where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be there.
His eyes flicked to Thurfian.
As Syndic Thurfian said, the Springhawk leaves in 4 hours.
Thank you,
Thalias said.
You're welcome.
He gave her a small smile.
Welcome to the Expansionary Fleet, caregiver Thalias.
And best of luck with that Skywalker. A moment later, Thalias and Thurfian were back out in the corridor.
Thank you,
Thalias said.
You were just in time.
I'm glad I could help,
Thurfian said, smiling.
You really are a remarkable person, Thalias.
She felt her face warm.
Thank you, she said again.
And as I helped you,
Thurfian continued,
there's something you can do to help me.
Thalias felt herself draw back from him.
Excuse me?
She asked carefully, coming to a halt.
Time is short,
Thurfian said, taking her arm and starting them moving again.
Come, I'll tell you on the way to your ship.
It had been 2 decades since Thalias had had to even read a military timetable, let alone follow one. Fortunately, once the initial shock wore off, old habits and reflexes took over, and she made it to the Springhawk shuttle in plenty of time. The young girl was waiting in the Skywalker suite's day room when she arrived, sprawled across a massive chair and playing a tap-click game on her questus. She looked to be 9 or 10, but Skywalkers tended to be on the short side, so that was only a guess. She looked up as Thalias came through the hatchway, gave the woman a rather suspicious-looking appraisal, then returned her attention to the game. Thalias started to introduce herself, remembered how touchy she'd usually been whenever a new caregiver came to call, and instead took her luggage to her part of the suite. She took her time getting settled. By the time she once again stepped into the day room, the girl had set her questus on the chair beside her and was gazing moodily at the line of repeater displays set into the bulkhead beneath the snack bar.
Have we left yet?
Thalias asked. The girl nodded.
A little while ago,
she said. She hesitated, then furtively looked over at Thalias.
Are you my new Momish?
I'm your new caregiver, Thalias said, frowning slightly.
Momish? Was that a new official term for her position? Or was it something this girl had come up with on her own?
I'll be taking care of you while we're aboard the Springhawk,
she continued as she walked over to one of the other chairs and sat down.
My name's Thalias. What's yours? Aren't you supposed to know already? This was kind of a last-minute assignment,
Thalias admitted.